Hello and welcome to episode 20 of the Evidence-Based Medicine podcast, where each week we pick a medical topic and cover the history, the evidence, and the guidelines and try to tell it like a story. I'm Daniel Aronov, and this week, another live broadcast from a talk I gave at the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners Conference, GP17. This one is just a bunch of great clinical pearls that I've found in the evidence over the years for the most common presentation in primary care, the respiratory tract infection. We'll talk about antibiotics for ear infection, for sore throat and for bronchitis, steroids for sore throat, Tamiflu, treatments for cough, and a few other random things in between. Now, I promise you, next week we'll go back to normal programming, with the standard 20-minute episodes, better quality sound, and all the other things you've got used to in the first 18 episodes. But for now, I hope you enjoy. Oh, and if you want to see this talk with the slides, then head on over to my YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/DrDanMD. DrDanMD. Enjoy! Thanks for coming, guys. Special thank you to those who are coming back after seeing yesterday's talk. Just to be upfront, this doesn't have all the songs and the dancing and live interactions with... So I know, you can leave now. I don't want to let you down. So this was very much an afterthought. So that ended up being a bit of a sort of magnum opus that took like 2 weeks of every spare minute I had. And this one, I actually started last night, went till 2 in the morning, and then again from 7 in the morning. So I got there, but so basically what I want to talk about today is also for those who weren't here yesterday, my favorite thing to do in the world, one of my favorite things to do is to review evidence and then present on it. So I do that in two sort of main ways. I make a video once a week for the general public, which goes for about 90 seconds, and it covers an evidence-based topic that the public are interested in, like does chocolate cause pimples, and it condenses the evidence into 90 seconds. And then I also make a podcast for doctors that looks at a medical topic, covers the evidence in detail, how it relates to history and guidelines, and how it relates to our practice. So this time I'm taking all the really great evidence that has really helped me in managing common presentations we see in GP in land, and that's respiratory tract infections. But before we begin, I need your opinion on something. So I left my belt at home, and so I just want to know, which is better, shirt out or shirt in with no belt? Because it just looks a bit weird with no belt, right? Out? Okay. I don't want to, you know, I want to maintain some professionality, but I don't want to look ridiculous with a shirt in with no belt. So thank you for that. It's very important feedback. All right. So basically, this is a smorgasbord of sort of clinical evidence-based pearls that I've picked up that's really helped my practice in terms of common respiratory tract infections. We're going to do 4 cases. So let's start with case 1. We have a 55-year-old male. Presenting complaint is, it's gone to my chest, doc. Can't get rid of it, doc. I think I need antibiotics to nip it in the bud. What does that mean? Nip it in the... Where does that... Anyway, so basically he developed a cough 2 weeks ago and it's been persistent since then. On examination, he's well, he's afebrile, his chest is clear, all his obs are stable. What are we going to do for him? We're going to give antibiotics? Who's going to give antibiotics? Put your hands up if you're going to give antibiotics. Put your hands up if you're not. Okay. So if you're not going to give antibiotics, the first thing you can do is reassure him. He's had a cough for 2 weeks. That is actually in keeping with a normal length of cough. So one study by a guy called Mark E. Bell in 2013 did 2 phases of his study. First, he cold called about 500 Americans and asked them how long they think a cough should last. And he found that they say about 5 to 7 days. And then he did a massive systematic review of every single trial that has ever been done on cough, you know, antibiotics for cough. There were cohort studies and there were randomized controlled trials. He found 19 and he looked at the average duration of the cough. If it was a cohort study, he just looked at the average duration of the cough. And if it was a randomized controlled trial, he just looked at the average duration in the placebo group. And he found that in fact, the average duration was about 18 days. So our expectations for how long a cough should last are actually very different to reality. And In kids, it's a little bit different. So a study in 2013 in the BMJ did the same thing with kids. So they found 48 studies with 22,000 kids, and they looked at the duration for each of the presenting respiratory tract infections. So for otitis media, they found that 50% got better by 3 days, and 90%, so the vast majority, got better by 8 days. Again, this is with no intervention. In the common cold, in kids, it was a bit longer than you'd expect. 50% had improved by 10 days, and 90% had improved by 15 days. With cough, 50% had improved by 10 days, 90% had improved by 25 days. And that's cough. That's not being acutely unwell. And that's probably what we'd call a post-infective cough syndrome. So what happens is the infection's gone, but all the debris and the battling that's been going on with your immune system has left some, cough stimulators in your respiratory tract, and that's now stimulating a cough that can last for several weeks to months after. Croup, 50% were better in 1 day, and 90% were better by 2 days. And finally, fever, 50% had improved by 3 days. So that's what we can expect, the normal resolution of symptoms of respiratory tract infections in kids. Now, antibiotics for bronchitis. So no one was going to prescribe antibiotics in this guy's cough. Unless any new people, I don't want to put you on the spot. But let's assume no one would prescribe. Well, what's the evidence? So there was a Cochrane done in 2007. They found 17 trials with about 5,000 people. And the main outcome was duration of cough. And they found that actually antibiotics reduced the duration of cough by about half a day. And this was assessed in 4 studies. And some studies looked at outcomes at 1 week. In other words, how many got better at 1 week. Some studies looked at how many got better by 2 weeks and some in between. So they pulled all of those together and found that on average, 50% of those in the placebo group got better within 1 to 2 weeks. But 68% got better with antibiotics within 1 to 2 weeks. So antibiotics work for bronchitis. The question is, it's a disease that would normally get better on its own. We're speeding it up. And is that benefit one that's particularly meaningful? Well, what I'd like to try and convince you is that that's a decision that only you and your patient can make, right? And that is going to be dependent on their clinical circumstances. You know, if they've got a cough and they're feeling unwell and, you know, they've got a wedding, their daughter's wedding in a week's time and they can't go to work, then that's a very different case to a guy who's got a cough, he's not bothered by it, where a 20% reduction in 1 to 2 weeks doesn't really make a difference. Does that make sense? So I discuss these numbers with patients when they come in for cough and sort of let them decide. All right, what else works for cough? Honey. Yeah. Damn you. You're not going to ruin my joke at the end, are you? So, as a matter of fact, there have been 3 trials that have assessed honey for cough. So these are all the trials that have looked at honey and its benefit for cough. One done in the United States in 2007, one done in Iran in 2010, and one done in Israel in 2012. Let's first look at the USA study in 2007. So they took 105 children, and they were aged between 2 and 18, and they randomized them to a honey-flavored dextromethorphan. Dextromethorphan is the number one most common over-the-counter cough syrup that we use. Okay? It's in Robitussin, Dimetapp, Vicks, Caldrol, Bisolvan, and Mucinex. So they gave them either a honey-flavored dextromethorphan preparation, or honey, or nothing. Or as I like to call it, sweet nothing. The outcomes, so there were 5 outcomes. It's part of what's called a cough symptom score. And there's 5 questions on this score. It's, you know, how frequent was your child's cough last night? How severe was your child's cough last night? How bothersome was your child's cough last night? How much did your child's cough affect their sleep last night? And how much did your child's cough affect the parents' sleep last night? So 5 questions, and they each have a score of 0 to 6. So 0 is not at all, and 6 is severely, right? And then somewhat is in between. So what they did is they came to one pediatric clinic in the USA, and then they said, do you want to be part of the study? The parents said yes. They said, okay, do this cough questionnaire for us. They did the cough questionnaire. Then they gave them their intervention for that night, which was either a syringe filled with this honey-looking dextromethorphan or a syringe filled with this honey. And then they called them the next day and asked them about the cough for the night before. So it's just an overnight study, and all three of these studies were the same. So compared to the night after they didn't take anything, there was still a 1-point reduction the next day, doing nothing. When they gave them dextromethorphan, there was a 1.5-point reduction on average in all the groups. And honey gave them a 2-point reduction. So for example, they started saying that my son's cough severity was a lot of the time. Doing nothing took it down the next day to some of the time. And giving honey took it down the next day to a little of the time. Does that make sense? So that was one study. But only one of those five outcomes was statistically significant, so no one really batted an eyelid when that came out. But then the second trial came out in Iran in 2010. They took 141 children, aged 2 to 5, and they randomized them to honey, dextromethorphan, which is what I mentioned before, diphenhydramine, which is another, the second cough suppressant, which we find in Australia in Benadryl. It's a sedating antihistamine that also has some cough-reducing properties, apparently. And sweet nothing. So four groups. And they were looking at the exact same outcome. So this questionnaire, they gave them as they recruited them, then they gave them one of the interventions that night, and then took the questionnaire again the next day. So what were the results? Well, nothing reduced the score by 1.5 points. Dextromethorphan and diphenhydramine reduced it by 2 points. And honey came out on top again, reducing the score by 2.5 points. Now, this study was very, very biased. They weren't blinded at all. They just literally gave them dextromethorphan, didn't try to make it look like honey or anything like that. And another weird thing about this study is that they reported that if the parents didn't know the answer to the questions, the pediatrician just wrote it down for them. So high risk of bias. So some people are like, okay, now that's two studies, but big eyelids weren't being batted yet. Then finally, in 2012, we have this study in Israel, which was the highest quality of all three studies. They took 270 children aged between 1 to 5, and they recruited them from 6 pediatric clinics. And they randomized them to 3 different types of honey or placebo. Because I always get asked, is Manuka honey, is this honey better, is that honey better? So they actually looked at 3 different types of honey. They didn't use any cough syrup controls. They just did honey versus placebo. One of them, in case you're a honey expert, one was eucalyptus honey, one was citrus honey, and one was... Does anyone know how to pronounce that? Labiate? Yeah? Let's go with that. Honey. And then placebo. The placebo they used was a salon date extract, which they report looks, smells, and tastes exactly like honey. So the outcomes were exactly the same. They took them the night when they presented to the pediatricians, then gave them the syringe, then the next morning took the survey again. They found exactly the same results. A 1-point reduction with placebo, and a 2-point reduction with honey, and it didn't matter which honey they got. And all of the outcomes, all 5 outcomes, were statistically significant in this one. So honey seems to work for cough, in kids at least. Ah, damn it. Any other treatments for cough? All right, so does anyone use Vicks VapoRub for cough? Yeah, so there is some evidence, and if you use it, great. If you don't use it, great. I don't think the evidence necessarily would persuade you to do one or the other. We'll talk about it now. So one study, and it was Paul, that Paul guy from the USA. Remember that Paul guy who also did the honey study in 2007? So it was the same team of researchers. So they took 138 children aged between 2 and 11, and they randomized them to Vicks VapoRub or a petroleum jelly, which feels and looks, but obviously doesn't smell like Vicks VapoRub. But they actually, and kudos to them, they tried their best to keep it blinded. And here's how they did it. So every family got Vicks and either Vicks or the petroleum jelly. The mother was told, before you rub the Vicks or the petroleum jelly on your child's chest, first put the Vicks on your nose so that would overpower the smell of what you're using, and then put whatever is in the unlabeled box onto your child, right? So they tried to blind for it. It turns out that most of the parents knew which arm they were in. You can just imagine them. and they also did no treatment. So the outcomes were pretty similar, but they added a few. It was the same 7-point scale, but they added rhinorrhea, congestion, and a few other things. So what did they find? Well, no treatment the next day gave you a 1-point reduction. Petroleum jelly gave you a 1.5-point reduction. And Vicks VapoRub gave you a 2-point reduction. But this is one study. And I don't know if you've heard of this, what's called the reproducibility crisis in the scientific literature at the moment. There's research that's found that when someone publishes a study, there's a 50% chance that the next study that's published on the same topic will have the opposite results. So we don't embrace one study results with open arms. The other issue with this study is that it was sponsored by the makers of Vicks VapoRub. And finally, there was really no blinding. But still, something else we could potentially offer. The other issue is that there was side effects. So 25% had burning to the skin, including 15% who had burning to their eyes. Okay, ready for case two? So 10-year-old boy presents with mum. He's got a severe sore throat, doc. Like, he's not eating as much. I mean, he's still drinking, but he's not eating as much. He doesn't have any cough, and there's no runny nose when you ask her and him. On examination, his temperature is 38.2. His obs are stable. His chest is clear. And when you look in his throat, it's red, but the tonsils aren't very impressive. There's no pus on them, and there's no, you know, erythema or swelling. Also, he has, when you palpate his cervical lymph nodes, they're a bit tender. So what are we going to do for him? Reassure? Who votes reassure? Yeah, so he's not Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander. Good question. Who's going to do something besides reassure? What are you going to do? Try dexamethasone. Good. We'll talk about that. What else would we try? Pain relief. And what else? Yep. Yep. Would anyone do antibiotics? Okay. So let's review the evidence. So firstly, is it bacterial? Right? So what's the best clinical tools we can use without doing tests to see whether it's a bacterial throat infection? So this guy called Robert Senter in 1981 did a big cohort study in his hospital where he took every single patient presenting with sore throat, took a detailed history and a detailed examination, wrote down the examination and the history findings, and then on every single one of them did throat swabs, right, for strep throat. Then for each of the symptoms and the signs, he did likelihood ratios. So what was the sensitivity, what was the specificity, and what was the likelihood ratio? And he came up with four symptoms and signs that were the most likely to predict a bacterial throat infection. Well, not a bacterial throat infection, but a positive strep throat swab test, okay? And they were tonsillar exudates, so not swollen tonsils, but pus on the tonsils, swollen tender anterior lymph nodes, lack of cough, and history of fever. And he created this scoring system, which has since been validated, called the CENTAUR score. And it's been updated by a guy called McIsaac, called the McIsaac score. But let's keep it simple. Go to the CENTAUR score. So what is the score and what is the likelihood of a positive throat swab? So if you have a score of 0, your chance of having a positive throat swab is 2.5%. If your score is 1, in other words, you have one of these four things, then your chance of having a positive throat swab is 6.5%. If you have a score of 2, the chance goes up to 15%. If your score is 3, 32%. And if your score is 4, which is a maximum score, your chance goes up to 56%. Now, this is your chance of having a positive swab, which might not necessarily be a bacterial throat infection because there might be a false negative rate. But this is the best we can do, okay? So this score is widely used. It's made its way into guidelines. In the UK NICE guidelines, they recommend using antibiotics if your score is three or four and not using antibiotics if it's 1 or 2. So what was our patient? So did he have tonsillar exudates? No. Did he have swollen tender anterior lymph nodes? Did he have lack of cough? Yes. Did he have history of cough? History of fever? Yes, he did. He had a 38.2 in the rooms. So his score is 3. So what I do in my practice is I explain this to the patient. I say, based on the examination we've done today, the chance of your child having a bacterial throat infection is about 30%. So what will antibiotics do in that case? Let's look at the evidence. So there's two reasons why you might want to give antibiotics for a strep throat or a tonsillitis. One is to improve symptoms, and one is to reduce complications. Let's start, and by the way, reducing complications means suppurative complications, things that, suppurative just means like pus related. So like quinsy or, you know, a sinusitis, and non-suppurative complications is like rheumatic fever and glomerulonephritis. So let's start with symptoms, using antibiotics to help with symptoms. So again, a Cochrane review in 2013, 27 trials with nearly 13,000 kids, patients. The main outcome they were looking for was who still had a sore throat at day three. In those who didn't get antibiotics and who got placebo, 66% still had a sore throat at day three. In the antibiotic group, 45% had a sore throat by day three. So there is a benefit with antibiotics. Again, I give these numbers to the patients and let them decide, or decide together, because it's going to be very different if it's, you know, a CEO of a company who's got a big meeting in 3 days who might love that extra 20% chance that they might get better, right? Who still has a sore throat at day seven? In the placebo group, it was 18%, and in the antibiotic group, it was 9%. So the vast majority get better with time, by 7 days, okay? Antibiotics do help a little bit. All right, what about non-suppurative complications? Let's start with rheumatic fever. So this same Cochrane review found that in the placebo group, 1.6% developed rheumatic fever. And on antibiotics, 0.6% rheumatic fever. But this was the analysis for rheumatic fever. Basically, what you can see here is all these studies on the bottom are showing reductions in rheumatic fever with antibiotics. All these studies at the top are showing no reduction with antibiotics because no one developed rheumatic fever in the trials. And if you look more closely, you can see that all of these were sort of done before 1950 and 1960, and every single trial that's been done since there has not been able to find a case of rheumatic fever. The reason is that rheumatic fever, for reasons we don't fully understand, maybe due to sanitization, maybe due to antibiotics, is just not occurring in, you know, not high-risk communities in Australia and in the developed world. So the therapeutic guidelines recommend, outside of these high-risk patient groups, of which the three high-risk patient groups are Indigenous communities, if the patient has a history of scarlet fever, or if the patient has a history of rheumatic fever. So outside of these groups, non-suppurative complications of S. pyogenes infection are now so rare in Australia that routine antibiotic use is no longer indicated, because all the trials done since 1960 have not had a single case of rheumatic fever. And in Australia, we just don't see it anymore, unless outside of Indigenous communities. Okay, what about glomerulonephritis? Well, this was the Cochrane review on glomerulonephritis. Here, you can see that in the total analysis, there was about 5,200 patients, and only two developed glomerulonephritis. So it's a really rare complication, and again, the therapeutic guidelines don't recommend giving therapy for that. So what have we got so far? We've got that it reduces symptoms and probably doesn't reduce complications, or non-suppurative complications. Let's go to suppurative complications. So quinsy, placebo group, 2.3% developed quinsy, and with antibiotics, 0.3% developed quinsy. So there is a reduction in suppurative complications like quinsy and also otitis media, which happened at 2% in the placebo group and 0.6% in the antibiotic group. So again, it's not clear cut, right? Which is why you see guidelines changing from this to that to this to that. The evidence is constant. The evidence hasn't changed. It's our interpretation of the evidence which changes. I say the best way to deal with the evidence is to discuss it with your patient. And obviously, all the side effects of antibiotics need to be taken into account as well, which I'll discuss later. All right, what else works for sore throat? Someone already gave it away. So corticosteroids. Let's review the evidence for corticosteroids. So something like prednisolone or dexamethasone for sore throat. Who uses corticosteroids in sore throat? Yep, I use it less now, but I use it. Okay, so the Cochrane review in 2012 found 8 trials with 743 patients, so not big trials, right? And all of these trials Well, antibiotic plus steroid versus antibiotic alone, right? None of these were just steroid versus placebo. All of these had a baseline antibiotic, and then they were comparing corticosteroid on top of that or just antibiotic, all right? So the main outcome was how many were better after 24 hours. And those who were just taking antibiotic, 12% were better after 24 hours. But those who were taking antibiotic and steroid, 39% were better after 24 hours. In terms of how many were better after 48 hours, 47% were better if they were just taking antibiotics versus 77% if they were taking corticosteroids and antibiotics. So things are looking good for corticosteroids. But then, this year, a trial in the UK went and sort of ruined everything. I don't know if you guys heard this study. It made a lot of press. It was a primary care study, so, you know, get excited. They took 565 patients, which was by far more than any of the studies in the original Cochrane Review. And they gave them corticosteroid versus placebo only, no antibiotics. If the doctor thought they needed antibiotics now, they were excluded from the study, right? And the corticosteroid they used was just a one stat dose of oral 10 milligrams dexamethasone or an oral placebo. The main outcome they were looking for was resolution of symptoms at 24 hours. And there was no improvement. So now what do we do, right? What's better, a Cochrane review of little sort of crappy studies or one big randomized controlled trial, right? They did about 50 secondary outcomes, and they showed one that was positive, and that was symptom resolution at 48 hours. That looked better. It went from something like 34% to 16%. Sorry, who still had symptoms, right? So this was marketed in the media as a positive study, but I actually spoke to the author who was at the PCRIS conference who presented on this paper, and the authors definitely do not think this is a positive conference, a positive result. When you do analyses of like 50 outcomes, you expect one or two to become positive, right? Just by statistical chance. So puts us in a bit of predicament. The other thing that came out within the same month of this study was in the BMJ, and it was the first. So we always thought that a 5 days of prednisolone or a stat dose of dexamethasone was safe, right? You're not going to get osteoporosis. You're not going to get Cushing's, right? 5 days is safe. But then this study came and again ruined everything. It was in April in 2017, this year, in the BMJ. And they basically took a large cohort in America of private insurance people. And the cohort they followed, there was 1.5 million people, and they followed them over 3 years. And the average that they used them for was 6 days. The majority of reasons was for upper respiratory tract infections, spinal conditions, so like back pain and allergies. The primary outcome they were looking for was how many developed sepsis, fractures, or venous thromboembolism within 30 days from taking the steroid, okay? And they did something really good. So cohort studies, you're probably all thinking now, well, clearly if they took the steroid, they were sick. So obviously they're going to have more sepsis, more fractures, right? But they compared them to themselves, right? So if someone took a steroid, they compared the 30 days after they took the steroid to 30 days in their past, right? To see whether the 30 days immediately after the steroid developed more of these complications than the 30 days in that same patient when they didn't take the steroid, okay? So what they find, with sepsis, there was an 80% increase in sepsis, very low, so it went from 0.1% to 0.18%. Venous thromboembolism, it doubled the risk, it went from 0.24 to 0.46. And fractures increased as well by 66%, it went from 0.14% to 0.21. So look, this is really, really low, and that's because we're only looking at 30 days, but still, and it's not the best evidence either. It's cohort studies, but it's blown that whole corticosteroids are safe for short-term use out of common thinking. So something else to think about when giving corticosteroids for a sore throat. All right, shake the sore throat out of our system. Let's go to case three. So now we have a 65-year-old female who presents with 48 hours of severe myalgias, fevers, headache, and can't get out of bed. On examination, temperature's 39.2. Obs are stable. Chest is clear. What do we think's going on? Flu. What are we going to do? Tamiflu. So who votes Tamiflu? Who votes not Tamiflu? Okay, what if this was 36 hours? Who votes Tamiflu? What if this is 24 hours? Who votes Tamiflu? Okay, interesting. So not heavy prescribers of Tamiflu. Is that what the sense I'm getting? Okay. So does Tamiflu work for the flu? Now, this is a question that requires a bit of history because it took 13 years to figure out if Tamiflu works. And it was through a lot of industry problems and hiding information that it took that long to get the details. Allow me to explain. So in 1999, the FDA approved Tamiflu based on two randomized controlled trials. In 2002, the WHO called for nations to stockpile Tamiflu. In 2003, a guy called Kaiser and his colleagues published a paper on Tamiflu showing 55% reduction in complications. The problem was that this was a paper that reviewed 10 studies, of which only two were published, and all of the authors were either funded by Roche, who made Tamiflu, or worked directly for Roche. Okay? In 2008, a Cochrane review showed the reductions in complications with Tamiflu. And they used this study, which made up two-thirds of their data. Then in 2009, swine flu hit, and governments were spending billions of dollars on Tamiflu. Why? Because it reduced complications, right? If we can save our citizens' life, if we reduce hospitalizations and reduce pneumonia. And it was based primarily on this Cochrane review, which was based on this one study, which was a review of 10 other studies, of which 8 we had never seen. Is everyone with me so far? Okay. Then something revolutionary happened. A Japanese pediatrician by the name of Kaiji Hayashi posted a comment on the Cochrane Review's article. So not even an editorial, not even a commentary in a journal, literally just like a blog, right? The Cochrane Review went up, and then like a blog, he just responded. He was basically trolling, right? And it started a revolution. He started off by saying, you know, we have some questions in the conclusions in your oseltamivir review, especially about the prevention of complications. And he was saying, what is the magnitude of the reduction in complications? We don't have that data. And secondly, we don't have eight of the studies that you're reporting. So the lead author of the Cochrane Review, he actually humbly agreed with him straight away within a month, said, you're absolutely right. And he contacted Roche and said, give us the rest of the studies. 4 years of backwards cat and dog with Roche until they finally got the study. So it started with Roche saying, we'll give it to you, but you have to sign a confidentiality clause, right? In other words, you can't publish the results, okay? Now, the whole point of Cochrane is that everyone else can review the results and make their own conclusions about it. So they said no. Later, Roche said that they had sensitive data, date of births and initials of the patients, and that's why they couldn't share it. But at the same time, if you read the confidentiality clause they wanted to make with the Cochrane, they said that you can't discuss the contents of the confidentiality clause with anyone else. That was part of the confidentiality clause. So, okay, then about a couple of months later, they gave them like a few pages of their trial reports. Now, trial reports is what you have to submit to the regulators. If I do a trial and I want my drug to be approved based on that trial, I, one, publish something in the literature, which is a few pages, right? But I've also got the trial report, which is individual patient data. It goes for about 200 pages. It's all in Courier New, like 10-point font, right? Double-spaced. And that's what they give to the FDA or to the TGA. So the Cochrane Review wanted that data so they could make their own conclusions. So what they did is they gave them a few pages from some of them. It was basically completely useless. But the Cochrane Review reviewed those pages, and some of those pages were pertaining to the two randomized controlled trials that they had published. And they saw real holes in what they reported in the article versus what was in the patient reports. So, for example, they reported an improvement with pneumonia, But when you look at the patient reports, it was like patient's perception of pneumonia. So whether the patient thought they had pneumonia, there was no like testing to see whether it does, and a bunch of other holes like that. So this big campaign started. The British Medical Journal started an entire campaign to get the papers off Roche. You can even see it now. They've got a whole website dedicated to it with an amazing interactive timeline of all the sequences of event in this whole Tamiflu saga. Eventually, in 2009, the lead authors of Cochrane just said, all right, well, we're going to omit that Kaiser paper from our Cochrane review, and they got rid of two-thirds of their Cochrane review from that. Finally, in 2013, Cochrane Review got the data from Roche after a big, heavy campaign. So what they found was that there were three published RCTs in the data that Roche finally gave the Cochrane, and eight unpublished randomized control trials, including one study with 1,500 adults. Now, this is patients who are volunteering, you know, their health and their time to benefit society, not benefit the drug company's pocket, right? They also found one study with 401 adults with chronic cardiac and respiratory diseases, which is the answer we've always wanted to know. Is the benefit of Tamiflu better if you've got COPD or if you've got heart failure, right? They didn't publish that study. And they had three trials with patients over 65. That's the other question we want to know. Over 65 are high-risk people. Is Tamiflu better in that population? In the meantime, $18 billion were made on Tamiflu, and the vast majority was on government stockpiles, thinking that it reduced complications. So did it reduce complications? Well, since then, there's been 26 systematic reviews on Tamiflu. A study found that when there was financial conflicts of interest, they were five times more likely to report the benefits of Tamiflu. All right, so what is, you know, a non-biased systematic review of Tamiflu? What did it find? So one of the best ones was, again, by this Mark E. Bell guy in 2013, and he reviewed 11 studies, 11 randomized controlled trials with 5,000 patients. He found the average symptom duration overall went from 7 days in the placebo group to 6.3 days in the oseltamivir group. If treatment was initiated within 24 hours of symptoms, then there was a 20-hour reduction in symptoms. If treatment was initiated between 24 to 36 hours, then there was a 12-hour reduction in symptoms. Now, what about those studies that they didn't publish? So in the adults over 65, there was a 7.5-hour reduction in symptoms. If they, in that study where they only recruited people with a history of cardiac or respiratory diseases, there was no significant difference in duration of symptoms. And what about complications? Well, there was no reduction in pneumonia and no reduction in hospitalization. So that's Tamiflu. So does it work? Yes. Does it reduce complications? There's good evidence that it doesn't. Was there unethical techniques used by the drug manufacturer to make money? Absolutely. Okay. By the way, it wasn't illegal of them. So if you publish a study, there's no law that says you, if you, sorry, do a, conduct a study, there's no law that says you have to publish the study, okay? Since then, there's been massive campaigns by Ben Goldacre and others to try and make people publish their studies. Okay, this is the last case. Should we stretch it out? All right, case four. We have a three-year-old girl with an earache. She gets sick all the time, doc. Is there something wrong with her immune system? You haven't seen that before, have you? No. Apparently it happens occasionally. Okay, on examination, she's got a temperature of 38.6. She's grizzly but well-looking, and her left tympanic membrane is bulging and red. What are we going to do? Sorry? She's had the symptoms for like 24 hours. So she woke up last night in the middle of the night with complaining, and it took an hour of giving her Nurofen and to try and settle her back to sleep. She's not Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander, thank you. So what are people going to do? So regular analgesia and not antibiotics. Any other options? Is anyone going to give antibiotics? Delayed prescribing? Yeah, so we're clearly a different cohort here than what you see in Beach data. I think GP17 selects for the best of the best GPs. So 90% of us, according to Beach data, are prescribing antibiotics, but zero people in this room are prescribing antibiotics. That's great. What was your question? Yeah. So it depends. It depends on the clinical examination. All right, good. So let's look at, firstly, let's cover this issue is there a problem with my immune system? All right, I get asked this a lot, so I actually dug up the evidence and found this. That the average number of respiratory tract infections you can expect per year are in children 8. Normal, healthy children is 8. In adults, normal, healthy adults, on average it's 3, which means that 50% are having more than 3. And in the elderly, it's 1. So clearly as our immune system comes across more and more bugs as we age, we're less, you know, susceptible to becoming clinically unwell with the bugs that we come across. Okay, what about acute otitis media in children? How common is that? Well, there's a greater than 80% chance that a child prior to the age of 3 will develop at least one episode of acute otitis media, and a 40% of kids will have 6 or more episodes by the age of 7. So this is a common problem. Now, this is old data, and it's from Pittsburgh in America, and it's from 1997, but they found that 42 days are spent on antibiotics before 12 months of age, and majority of which is for acute otitis media. So, seven, many weeks. Carry the one. Okay. And in the second year of life, 49 days are spent on antibiotics, which is 7 weeks. Thank you. Thank you for playing at home. Okay. So let's look at the evidence for antibiotics for acute otitis media. Again, there's two reasons why we'd want to use antibiotics in acute otitis media. One is to improve symptoms, and one is to reduce complications. Let's start with antibiotics on symptom reduction. So a Cochrane done in 2015 found 13 randomized controlled trials with 3,500 kids. And the main outcome they were looking for was symptom reduction at 2 to 3 days. And 7 studies have reported on this. In the placebo, 84% had complete symptom resolution by 2 to 3 days. And in the antibiotic group, 89% had complete resolution by 2 to 3 days. So we could say, look, antibiotics don't really work, but they do. So what else can our approach be? Well, you know, there's a good chance, an 85% chance your child will get better by 3 days without antibiotics. Antibiotics will increase that chance to 90%. Most patients in my experience say, well, I'm not really interested. But again, it's between you and the patient. So if it's a really, really sick child and they're vomiting and they're fever and they're not eating, I would take that 5% increase in chance, right? But if they're well and they're okay and the mum's handling it and you trust the family, then maybe that 5% chance isn't significant. It's up to you and the doctor. Well, that's my approach anyway. Okay, what about complications? So 5 studies looked at the outcome of tympanic membrane perforation. And they found that in the placebo group, 5% were developing a perfed eardrum. And in the antibiotic group, 1.8%. So antibiotics reduce your chance of perforated eardrum by a 3% absolute reduction. And, you know, perfed eardrums are horrific for families, right? Wake up with pus all over the ear. The kid feels amazing now, right? They're not in pain anymore, but the mum is like panicking. And you can understand why. It's quite, you know, seeing pus coming out of the ear is quite devastating. But the good news is that the vast majority heal without any complications. And when they look at tympanometry at 3 months, there's no difference. So no impact on hearing at 3 months as far as we can tell. Okay. Now, what about the harms of antibiotics? Well, this same Cochrane review, and I'm not going to talk about harms that are starting to come to the forefront, like issues on microbiota and, you know, allergies and irritable bowel syndrome and all those sorts of things. We don't have good evidence on that, but we have certainly signals in the evidence that antibiotics may contribute to that, especially in the first couple of years of life. But the Cochrane review found that rash, vomiting, and diarrhea occurred in, you know, about 20% in the placebo group. Oh, that's wrong. It's 27% in the antibiotic group. So I think this slide happened at like 3 a.m. Okay. But one study, so the problem with randomized controlled trials is they're really looking for one outcome. Okay, when I conduct a study, The whole study surrounds one outcome. How I'm going to decide how many patients I recruit, which statistical tools I'm going to use, that is all dependent on the one outcome called the primary outcome. So the studies aren't really geared to look at secondary outcomes, including harms. And often studies don't even ask patients about harms like rash, right? So a lot of the studies in the Cochrane Review didn't specifically ask about harms. But this study was one of the best trials that really, really took their time to ask about harms. It was by Tattinen in 2011. And by the way, they gave Augmentin to these kids, Augmentin Duofort, which is becoming very popular in America and sadly in Australia too. So they found that diarrhea increased by 17% absolute increase. So that's a number needed to harm of around 5 to 6, which means every 6 kids you give an antibiotic to, you're going to give them diarrhea. Okay? Nappy dermatitis, 31% absolute increase, which means that about 1 in 3 to 1 in 4 kids you give this to are going to get nappy dermatitis. Now, as a parent with 2 kids, you know, under 3, nappy dermatitis is a nightmare, right? You're like trying to give them nappy free time. Meanwhile, they're peeing all over the place. You're like rubbing zinc cream on their bum all the time. And like when you want to wipe their bum, it's so painful for them and they're crying and they're miserable. It's not as simple as you think. It's a really devastating harm. Well, devastating is probably a bit extreme. It's a bad thing. Okay. The other thing they found was that oral thrush went from 1% in the placebo group to 5% in the antibiotic group. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've got maybe 5 or 10 minutes for some questions.
Okay, so I actually really, really wanted to make a slide on delayed antibiotics because it works. Okay, it absolutely works. So if you look at, there's been a Cochrane review, there's been heaps of trials on delayed prescribing of antibiotics. So there was delayed anti-prescribing or immediate anti-prescribing or saying no, you can't have antibiotics. What they found was in those who got the script, something like 90 to 95% of them filled the script, which is remarkable. We don't see that in any other aspect of medicine. If you give someone an antihypertensive, what's the chance of them filling the script? It's around 70%. So here we're seeing 90 to 95% of them filling the script if they got the script. If they got told not to be given the script, if they said absolutely no, you can't have the script, then about 15 to 20% still used antibiotics at the follow-up. So how did they get it? Well, either they got sicker and they went to a different doctor and got it, or they just went straight to a different doctor and got their script. Or they used their wife's leftover amoxicillin that was sitting, who knows? They used the antibiotics, so 20%. Giving them a delayed script, only like 30 to 35% use the antibiotics, okay? So it's a very, very effective strategy. It takes the antibiotic use down from 95% down to about 30%. And then saying absolutely no doesn't give that much benefit on top of that. So delayed prescribing is a very, very useful tool, and it overcomes all those barriers. So doctors want to give the script. You know, if you look at studies that ask doctors, why do you give the script? The 90% of doctors in the Beach study, none of you, who give the script for antibiotics, why do they give it even though they're taught not to? One is because it's quicker. Two is because they don't want to argue with the patient. And three is because they're concerned of complications. So delayed script overcomes all three of those, right? It's one more sentence, so it's just as quick. You don't have to worry about complications because if they're going to get sicker, they've got the script right there. It's a very, very effective strategy. It's not for all doctors, but you should know and be, find favor in the fact that it works. It reduces antibiotic prescribing. And then in the Cochrane Review, when they looked at clinical outcomes in those who got a delayed script versus those who got an immediate script, there was no difference. So it's also safe. I think, yep.